George Leeson, Rio 2.
Well, there were already a few. They were just gathering together enough to form a battalion. Yes. And the group that I came with, we were made the nucleus of what became Number 2 Company, Fry's Company, the machine gun company. Yes. And we stayed in a place. It varied. A lot of the lads in Madrigueras, they had to sleep just to sleep on the floor. On palliasses, but the room which we was a big long room, and the local Popular Front Committee were marvellous. They made little wooden truckle beds for each one of us, and we had a straw palliass to sleep on, so we were sort of in luxury compared with some of the others who were just sleeping on the floor. Well, then of course we had the training in Madrigueras, and well, I don't know if have people recorded to you the people in Madrigueras were absolutely marvellous. You know this Jason Gurney book, The Last Crusade, where he says that the people in Madrigueras were indifferent to the war and so on, was absolute nonsense. These people were so fervently Republican. Well, of course, there were anti-Republican people who were keeping very quiet there. There were some of the women, there was a rumour going round that the women of the village had a priest hidden in the village and were having private religious, well, so it wouldn't have done any harm anyway, but the people were tremendous. If you went, for instance, this good wine needs no bush, the peasants there had wine for sale, always had a bush over the door, and if you went round with your water bottle to try and buy some wine from them, you couldn't buy any. They filled your water bottle for nothing. And you couldn't buy anything in the shops. You see, when we were paid, while we were there, the pay went up from 1 peseta a day, 3 pesetas a day, 6 pesetas a day, and then 10 pesetas a day. 10 pesetas at that time was quite a lot of money. We got paid every 10 days. At the end of the 10th day, when we got paid our 100 pesetas, we already had best part of the previous lot left because you couldn't spend it. And we were giving it in, paying it back into Socorro Rojo Internacional. We didn't need money. One of the things, this young lad from that I told you about, underground, from the Transport Salaried Staff Association, he and I were together very much there. And when we went for the evening meal in what was left of the church, regularly, as you went there to go through the door, there were crowds of the local villagers who would be waiting to take one of the international brigaders away to their own home to give them a meal. So our cooks had a very light job for the evening meal because about half the battalion wouldn't be there. They would be taken out. Now, there was one family that adopted the two of us, and they used to grab us every night. They took us away. Now, it struck us straight away as of an extraordinary thing that when we got to their place, there was the table laid for the two of us to eat. And the family was, oh, no, no, we've already eaten. Well, you know damn well what was happening. Yeah. They weren't eating. They were giving everything they had to us. And they served us. We had eggs and chips. We had even meat occasionally, which was a rare thing there. And they were feeding us there, and they were so pleased to see us. Well, I remember one day, this other young lad, they had duros then, 5 peseta pieces, big as an English old crown. And he gave one of these to the little boy, and the little boy was playing it on the mat, and the mother saw it. And there was hell to play because he'd given the boy this money, insisted on him taking it back. Well, when eventually we knew that we were soon going to front because we were issued with these real rifles, we hadn't any rifles before, these Russian rifles, we knew we were going in a few days, there was a market in the village square, and we bought a beautiful pair of bellows, because the only way they had of blowing up their fire, which was a bit of old rubbishy wood, was a long pipe which they used to blow through. So we bought a pair of bellows, and we had hell's delight trying to get this woman to accept this pair of bellows, because she wouldn't take it. She said, we give to you, you don't give to us, to get this is a gift for us, because when we go away, we're bound to go away sometime, we want you to remember us, but that we got eventually to accept us. Now, another few, there are all sorts of experiences there. One day, we were fallen in on parade because we were told that Lago Caballero was coming around to visit us. And we were already fallen into the parade there. He didn't come because at the last minute something happened. He never did come after standing there for ages. The entire village put on their Sunday best clothes to come along there to be there. Of course, they were disappointed as well that Lago Caballero didn't visit. They were absolutely tremendous to us, the people in that village. Now, I don't want to dwell with much on Madrigueras except when we left. When we left to go to the front, because, of course, they didn't give advance orders like that. They didn't give information ahead of time. All they told us was that late that night, that we had to get up early in the morning and go to the parade ground and draw our ammunition because we would be leaving.
Who was giving the orders at this stage?
This was McCartney still. I'll tell you a bit about that too. This was McCartney still, even though perhaps we're getting on to rather delicate ground. And so the next morning, the villagers got to know, somebody told them we're leaving for the front. The next day, we fell in on the parade ground, the entire village, again, all their Sunday best clothes on. Wasn't it? They're all dressed in their Sunday best. And as we left in these trucks, the entire village, as we went down the street, they all came running and running after us. And my last memory of Madrigueras there is the entire village standing there weeping and waving to us as we rode. We might have been their own sons that had been going away there. Well, when we got, this is a bit about, when we got to the railhead at La Gineta, the war in Spain was continually waiting around and standing around and what's going to happen next and so on, waiting there for ages for the train to come in there. And then we suddenly noticed that Tom Wintringham was in command. There were no sign of McCartney. Tom Wintringham. Now, this, I hope I'm not upsetting anybody, but this was a tremendous shock to the battalion, particularly in my company. Because suddenly, McCartney, whom nobody liked anyway, and I think was a complete poser, and never should have been put in command of the battalion at all, with his 1914 ideas, I could say a lot about him. Anyway, whether they liked him or not, suddenly to find that your battalion commander is not there. And there's another man, Wintringham, who'd been a kind of instructor, and he said, in command. What on earth? Well, maybe McCartney will join us up at the front there. And then all sorts of rumours started to go around. McCartney's deserted. McCartney's committed suicide. Peter Kerrigan has shot McCartney, which eventually turned out to be the truth anyway. Now, it's a very demoralising thing for a group of men like this going into action, suddenly to find out there's a new battalion commander and the mysterious circumstance in which the previous battalion commander. And it's a very difficult thing for a man like Tom Wintringham to take over command of the battalion at a moment's notice, just as it's going into action. That's a criticism. I don't know if anything could have been done about it, except perhaps changing the command before. Well, then we...
You were saying you could say a little about McCartney.
Yes. Well, McCartney was disliked by the men because a number of things. McCartney's attitude was not regarded by them as being the attitude of the type of army that we were. Now, I know some of the lads wanted to elect their own officers. This is a ridiculous idea. But nevertheless, whether you elected your own officers or not, even though you accepted the fact this would have been ridiculous, you wanted an army with strict military discipline. Nevertheless, McCartney had a little villa where he lived and ate and was served by servants and so on.
Madrigueras.
Yes, a Madrigueras little villa. He didn't eat in the church with us. He ate there separately. And he would stroll down to the parade ground with his swagger cane and so on. Now, a lot of the lads thought, all right, all the other company commander ate in the church with us. Why didn't the battalion commander, he could still have kept his respect, why didn't he mix with us and eat with us in the church? And all sorts of things. For instance, we had five rifles there, five or six rifles, old Spando rifles, and McCartney had sentries posted with no ammunition, just the empty rifles. One sentry was up in the top of the church tower, and he was supposed to be looking out for aerial attacks, aircraft attacks. We were about 200 miles away from the nearest enemy point, so we didn't need that tool for the air. We would have got warning by other means, by telephone from Albacete or something. Another sentry with an empty rifle stood at the church door, and he never knew what he was doing. What was he supposed to be guarding? Was he supposed to be stopping fascists from going in the church? Or this, and he never knew why he was posted at the church door, because the church was our dining hall. One day, this sentry there got so fed up standing there that he propped his rifle against the door of the church and went in to have his meal. McCartney came along and saw this empty rifle, grabbed it, went round to the guard room and said, "Sergeant of the guard, bring two men and follow me." Went in and then held his rifle and said, "Who is the man who was supposed to be sentry at the door?" Fall in, marched him off to the guard room. And another thing, the London Trades Council sent a delegation down to meet us. And they were coming along by car from Albacete, and it poured with rain in January. It was rain, rain, rain. And these Spanish villages at that time, the road was either hard-baked mud or soft mud up to your knees. And when it rained and rained, the mud, red mud, was up to your knees. And we were turned out ages before this arrived, waiting to arrive, standing, lining the route in the pouring rain, and swearing and miserable and so on. Eventually the car came in sight, the London delegation coming along like that. Now, they made a very wise decision. As soon as they saw us standing there in this mud and so on, instead of driving along in the car or getting out and walking straight into McCartney's villa, they got out, and with their nice clothes on, they walked up to their knees in mud right through the rain, and that cheer the lads up. We thought, marvellous, these people doing that. And I think it was a very good thing for them to have done. We had a meeting in the cinema that night, and they brought us great packets and packets of English cigarettes and bars of chocolates that they'd brought out for us. The lads were so pleased. Then McCartney got up on the stage to speak, and we thought, oh, he will thank them on behalf of the battalion. So, not here, he said, "Oh, it's all right for the London Trade delegation to come out here. Very good for them to come out and give us cigarettes and chocolates. But they would have done much better if instead of that they brought us prismatic compasses so that we could make some night raids into enemy territory." And the faces of this delegation dropped like that. He had this bee in his bonnet that the war was going to be won by night actions against the enemy. Thank God he never got in charge of the battalion, because he would have thrown the entire battalion away under such circumstances, where the enemy knew every inch of the ground and we didn't, carrying out night attacks across no man's land with prismatic compasses. McCartney.
What did you know from your own experience of the end of McCartney?
Well, I don't know. I don't know what happened. Oh, the story was that Peter Kerrigan was cleaning his revolver, and during the course of cleaning his revolver, it went off and hit McCartney in the arm or something. Nobody really believes that. Peter will never tell you on that. Our belief is that the quarrel developed, that Peter shot so-and-so. And no one certainly in my company would have believed that when it came out that Peter Kerrigan shot him, that Peter shot him by accident. that some quarrel had developed, because he wasn't a fit person. He was a psychological case. He wasn't a fit person to be in command of a battalion like that.
And he never re-emerged?
No, never. No, he went home to England after that.
Sure. Yeah. So Tom Wintringham then?
Tom Wintringham took command, yes. Until he was wounded. He was wounded on the second or third day at Jarama, in holding the sunken road. Because he tells you all that in English Captain. He doesn't tell you about how he took over from McCartney, doesn't he? He's sensibly silent on that point.
How was Wintringham appointed?
Well, no, I wasn't there. Peter could tell you. Peter Kerrigan could tell you about that, how he actually became, I mean, if Peter wants to tell the whole truth, how he came to be appointed as... Nobody knew. Wintringham had a rather anomalous position at Madrigueras. Nobody quite knew what he was, whether he was battalion second in command. As far as we knew, Wintringham was mainly the military instructor, because he had lectures on weaponry and so on, and Wintringham in the main did so. McCartney never carried out any military training. McCartney appeared on the parade ground like a 1914 officer, but he never took part in any of the training. Our company commanders took us out on training. Yes. And as there were no rifles, our training consisted of long route marches and learning artillery formation and learning how to take cover from aircraft when somebody blew. That was all. As far as weaponry is concerned, these old rifles and the shortage of ammunition, they rigged up a firing range, and each section at a time was taken, and they had time to go up the range, where they fired five rounds. Each man fired five rounds from these old rifles with spoon board. And that was the weaponry, that was the only weaponry training that it was possible to have before we went up the line. There weren't the rifles and weren't the ammunition. When eventually, the day that we were going up, the day before we went up there, we were issued with these Russian rifles, and we knew we were getting near the front. Then eventually, when we got to Villarubel de Santiago, near the front line, then we were given a chance to go out in the field and fire a few rounds across the hillside of these rifles so that the lads learned how to set the sights and how to load and fire these Russian rifles.
What was Peter Carrigan's place at that time?
I'm not sure whether he was brigade commissar. You see, the brigade was formed while we were there in Madrigues. André Marty came down, and we were formed into a brigade with other battalions. There was the Dimitrov battalion and the Franco-Belge battalion. We were formed into a brigade with these four other battalions who were in other villages around and whom we never met. We never actually met these battalions. When we went into action at Jarama, we knew that these battalions, as part of a brigade, were dotted along in our right flank, but we never actually met them as battalions at all prior to then, because they were in other villages around there, and they went up in different trains. We filled a complete train when we went up from La Gineta up to the front to Villanueva de Santiago, where, as I said, there we got these Maxim guns issued to us. And then from there we went to Chinchon and spent the night. And then before daylight, in the middle of the night, we were taken up to our positions and where we're going in at Jarama.
How effective was the training before that, when you actually came flying?
None at all. No, not effective. Not in the slightest. Not in the slightest. There was nothing. You see, it was just a case, really, of trying to... What are you going to get the men to do? And so just keep them busy doing something so they don't get demoralised, and keep them tough and strong as well. Take them out on long route marches. But the only thing they really learned was how to take cover from aircraft, you know. The blow whistle from aircraft, and you scatter from the road and lie face downwards, even if you put your head in a load of mule manure, you did that. And the other thing was forming artillery formation, which is arrowhead formation, which it turned out wasn't a very good formation for advancing in front of the enemy anyway. And that was all, other than these five rounds, fire five rounds. You see, for instance, they weren't really trained properly, because I know the men in my section, when we got into action, at Jarama, and I thought I'd have a look at some of my chaps who had rifles and were firing away, because I went round. It's because the section that I had command of there, I know when we got into a position there, into a firing position, I thought I'd check up with one or two of the chaps what range, to check up everybody was firing at what I thought would be the proper range. And when I asked them, what range have you got on your sights? What have you set your sights to? They didn't know what I was talking about. And the first lad I looked at, his sights were set at zero, so his bullets were ploughing into the ground about 50 yards in front of him. And then I'd find a whole lot of them. They didn't even know that they had to set their sights on the rifle, you know. And so the military training was nothing, really. Those who had had previous military training, I had, as being a seaman gunner, perhaps didn't need it so much. But I might have needed for that sort of warfare. But otherwise, there was nothing that was military training at all, really.
There was no tactical training.
No, no.
You had no idea about what tactics, what...
None at all, really. And a matter of fact, I mean, this is perhaps a criticism of the battalion command and so on, but when we were taken up, you see, I mean, all right, a certain amount of secrecy, isn't it? But when we were taken up from Chinchon, the company commanders might have been told, but I know with my section of the group, we did not know what position we were going into. We did not know that there'd been a heavy enemy breakthrough across the river, and there was a large-scale enemy offensive taking place. All that we knew, that we were going into the front line. Well, our lads, after kicking their heels for weeks and weeks at Madrigueras, sort of said, let's go and get at them. And I know from my own company, the great majority of the chaps in my own company thought that we were going into the offensive, that we were into the attack. And that's one of the reasons for the heavy casualties there at Kharama, was that our lads were not told that they were going into a defensive position and didn't know what they had to do to take up a defensive position. That you don't rush forward with your rifles like that. You see, all sorts of things. I mean, it's all right to criticise now, but I mean, it's a bit too late. For instance, that the positions that we were sent on, these bare hills where the grass was only about a quarter of an inch high, were not defensive positions anyway. There was nothing. I mean, even in a lying prone position, there was no cover whatsoever. And the more sensible thing, there were some Spanish militia holding a bit of the front, the more sensible position would have been to take us up there 2 days earlier and give us a position 5 miles behind where we were sent, 5 miles back, where we were given 2 days to dig defensive positions and then allow the militiamen gradually to drop back, and then we would have been able to hold that line. And the enemy, because that became the line eventually anyway, down near the Moreta de Juna road.
But you had no idea even that you were on the defensive.
No. Certainly my company didn't. Yeah. My company didn't. And I know one of the lads I was talking to there, who was in number one company with Kit Conway's, you see, and I know when he got there, he's an ex-soldier and so on, he got there, and immediately he got there, and a lot of them who, with number one company, we had more experienced people, because they had been in action, and they immediately got down and lay down to, and Kit Conway stood up and said, "Don't lie down, stand up and show you're not afraid of the fascist bastards." Well, the next thing, he got a bullet through him, you see, and a lot of his men were lost because they did that and stood up, you see, and they had no idea whatsoever. And also, there was a white house on top of the hill. And one of the section with the Max, not the Max, the type machine gun that wasn't a Maxi, that worked by a recoil from the explosion, I forget the name of the Max, the gun, it was like a Maxim gun, was sent up to take up their position in this white house. Now this was the only, it was not only white, painted white, whitewashed, but it was the only building anywhere around there. And if anything was a target for enemy artillery, was that. And so, of course, the moment a machine gun opens up from there, the enemy artillery run it right away, and that house went up like that, and the gun and people with it, you see, all sorts of things like that. Because of ignorance, and lack of communications, you see, the army, the battalion not being taken into confidence by its commander, not being told exactly. Our lads would have accepted if they'd been told, look, there's been a tremendous enemy breakthrough, the overwhelming forces coming across here. If they get across to the Arganda Bridge, they've got the Valencia Road, Madrid is cut off, somehow or another, you've got to hold that line, get up there, and you've got to dig yourself. Here's some spades, dig holes or something, get yourself into defensive positions, and hold it, and put in two lines, and if one line came back, another one. You see, but they were not told that. Well, this business about our machine guns, we got up there with 8 Maxim guns, dragged them over the hill, waiting for the ammunition. The chap going to get the ammunition had got drunk, this chap, and when he eventually arrived, it was the wrong ammunition. It was ammunition didn't fit these belts. And the feeder things which you fill them in didn't turn up either. So we had to park our 8 Maxim guns in an olive grove and grab rifles and go into action as riflemen. Until as Fred Copeman, eventually the ammunition did arrive, and so a lot of chaps were set to work filling the belts by hand, and it must have been about 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon before eventually we got them up. And as Fred Copeman described, we just actually mowed down this Moorish attack. They were coming charging through a horse, everything breaks, and they would have broken through but for these 8 Maxim guns having to be there by accident. And as I say, the enemy commander, thinking probably it was a marvellous tactic on our point of view to hold our Maxim guns in reserve.
What about the discipline of the members of your battalion? I mean, how strict was the kind of hierarchical discipline that you would get in the Second World War?
Well, it wasn't that. McCartney was trying to impose that. You see, I think McCartney had an idea that was the only sort of discipline you can impose on an army, and that he upset, because he had some tough characters there, you see. and he upset them even more. Now, you couldn't go to the other extreme of allowing these sort of revolutionary people to say, you know, we'll run the armies, we want and tell the commander, but there was a happy medium which he could never strike. And this, he upset them by establishing a guardhouse and having, you know, people being brought before him as the military commander and given 5 days detention and so on for all sorts of things like that, which made for indiscipline, not discipline, because the chaps were more ready to accept explanations of sensible type, which we, young Ball and I, with the chaps we brought out, who were none of them non-political, we were able to do this in explaining to them what the war was about and how, all right, you go out in the village and you have a drink, but you don't get roaring drunk because a soldier doesn't do that and you don't do this and you obey orders from your commanders and so on. And most of the lads were prepared to accept that, you see, particularly when the company commanders, as our company, came in and ate with us in the church. And when they ate with us in the church, they'd be Bill and Fred and Tom and Harry. But the moment we went on a route march or on the parade ground, the attitude towards them was that they were our officers, you see, and that there was, you didn't talk to them or accept them the same way as when they were sitting next to you at lunch. And the lads readily accepted that.
So, yes, there were officers and NCOs?
Yeah, yes, yes.
What was the ranking?
Well, they were appointed. You see, the thing is, just before we had, there were people appointed as company commanders and company second in command, and there were commissars. And we got nowhere beyond that. And then I was told, now you will be put in charge of a section, you see, which was a group within a company. And then not long before we get to the front, McCartney came onto the parade ground and he announced a number of military promotions and appointment, and so will become lieutenant, and so will become captain, and so will be sergeant corporal. See, these things were suddenly, just before we went into the front, when they had, you know, no, too late for them to have any real value at all, you see, they hadn't been, all it was company commander, and then suddenly company commander suddenly became lieutenant so-and-so or captain so-and-so. You see, there wasn't military ranking until then, and you would have been said you were section commander, section commissar and so on.
So you were a section commander?
Yeah, going, yes. Yes, right at the last, you see, right at the last. That I was told that.
Just before we went in,
yeah.
Well, what was the, how did orders reach you, George?
Well, from Fry, you see, who was the company commander.
Yes.
And the orders came from battalion to Fry and then were passed down.
And you had a system, there was a system of runners.
Of runners, yes, yeah.
How were they equipped? Just they physically ran?
Or? Oh, they physically ran, oh yes. There were no... there was a signals, there was a small signals unit. They did set up, they had telephone wires, because I know Wintringham, in the sunken road behind, did have a telephone wire to brigade headquarters. I think he had that, as well as having runners that went backwards and forwards. I believe he had a telephone system
that
worked.
So he kept in touch with his company commanders, and they kept in touch with...
Yes, he kept his company commanders by runners. This, you know, the thing that Fred Copeman raised about who was responsible when we were out on this ridge. Well, Wintringham was obviously responsible, because Wintringham, who was in the sunken road, we were here, and there was an olive grove, and then the sunken road, Wintringham, who had his battalion headquarters here, kept in touch with Fry by sending a runner backwards and forwards, and this runner came backwards and forwards and also brought a newly filled ammunition belt, because a group of men were sitting in the sunken road filling these ammunition belts by hand for the Maxim guns, and he would come over and give orders, give instructions. You see, and I know that Wintringham was the one who told Fry to stay in that position. Obviously, he
is now, perhaps for the benefit of this particular account, we could go through that again briefly. So Fry's instructions were to stay...
Yeah, as far as I know, must have been, because the fact that Wintringham, who was in the sunken road... as a matter of fact, we were told, because the night before, when it finally ceased down to the night, the cooks brought up some soup and we had a muster in the sunken road and found how woefully small we were from what we were. And then... I know Wintringham spoke to Fry, and Fry said, right, all number two company, plus a few reinforcements from other groups whom Wintringham gave him. Come with me, back the wall, take spades, dig yourself, dig holes in behind the wall and take up position there. And that's what we were told. We told her there to stick there.
Perhaps you can tell me about that operation. I know you spoke this afternoon about it, but could you just run through it again?
Well, you see, they eventually called it Suicide Ridge. There was a low wall, I don't suppose it was more than about 18 inches high, of just loose stones, and we were behind this. It was from this position that we had mown the fascists down the previous afternoon, the previous evening, when with Fred Copeman, which was a good position for that, but it wasn't a position to stay in, because it provided a blind spot. There was sloping ground in front, and then a big dip in the ground like that. Well, from the end of this sloping ground, I don't know how far it was, probably not more than 50 or 60 yards, most 100 yards, there was this dip in the ground in which there was a large area of ground which was completely invisible to us.